Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, January 8th, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. I hope you guys had a great holiday. Thank you so much for sticking with me through it. I'm really excited to be back with you, and I have a great episode for you today. I'm going to be talking to Nate Blakesley, who is the author of American Wolf, a true story of survival and obsession in the West. But before we dive into that, I want to thank those of you who have made Talk Nerdy possible this week and every week and from here until forever. It's because of the support from people like you that Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. There are a lot of ways you can support the show. You can shop in the Talk Nerdy store. You can tell your friends and family about it. You can rate it and review it on iTunes. But one way, a financial way that keeps the show going, and it really is a big chunk of my income as I continue to produce the show, is through pledging your support via Patreon. You just go to patreon.com/talknerdy, and there are a lot of options for you there. So I want to thank those of you who have done that this week, including Stefan A., Phil Tiber, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jonathan Wright, Christian Jeffrey, Stuart Oag, The Honorable Husband, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and of course, Jeffrey Sewell. And if you want to support the show on a one-time basis, you can go to my website and there's a PayPal portal there. And I want to thank John Arco and Eduardo Kalinowski for clicking through there and for pledging your support. You guys, I really, really do appreciate it. It means so much to me from the bottom of my heart. You're the reason that this show keeps on going strong. You're also very helpful for me in my time of need because, of course, if any of you follow me on social media, you may know that the reason there wasn't one more episode this past year in 2017 is because after doing a lot of work, long story short, doing a lot of work, very hard shoot day on the East Coast in snowy conditions and many, many, many more hours than I'm supposed to be working, and then multiple cancellations with the airline, I ended up having to overnight and wake up crazy early, functioning on very little sleep. And on my final flight home just before the holidays, I left my laptop on the plane. And of course, I got in touch with American Airlines. I knew exactly which flight I was on. I knew exactly which seat I was in. But alas, it appears that it was too late, even though I told them the day of. It's now been weeks and weeks, and they say they're still looking, but have yet to find it. I smile as I say this, but it was kind of difficult. It was a pretty dark week that first week. I lost a paper that I had just completed for school that I hadn't connected to the internet, so I hadn't had been able to upload it because I worked on it on that long flight. I lost an entire episode of Talk Nerdy that I recorded in New Zealand, which I'm going to have to re-record remotely. Really bums me out. And of course, I lost a lot of memories, a lot of photos, a lot of music. I have some backups, but some of my backups aren't where they need to be either, for some reasons that are my fault, some reasons that were beyond my control. But either way, it's a tough thing when you lose a piece of technology that is so much more than that, because a lot of your life is on it and a lot of your livelihood is on it. I really don't wish this on anybody. It's taught me a lot about redundant backups. It's taught me a lot about third-party services that I can use instead of just relying on iCloud. It's taught me a lot about tracking software, about tracking hardware. And of course, I am trying to set myself up so that nothing like that ever happens again in the future. But we had to buy a new machine, had to invest in some new software, and get everything back on track in time to start fresh this year. And it's because of support from you guys that I was able to do that. So again, I'm just really, really grateful that you've been sticking with me for so incredibly long. Talk Nerdy is such a fun show to do. It's such an important part of my life. It really does keep me going. And I feel so much closer to you guys, the Talk Nerdy listeners, because of the feedback that I get from you through social media and through other outlets. Oh, I'm also so excited to announce that Talk Nerdy won an award, the first award it's ever won, the Parsec Award for 2017. And of course, the Parsec Awards are a speculative fiction award, ceremony, award celebration. So almost every category is for sci-fi and fantasy in the fiction genre, but they do have one category called the Best Fact Behind the Fiction podcast. And I was up against some incredible finalists. Universe Today's Guide to Space by Fraser Cain, just a wonderful show. Planetary Radio by Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society. Metatrex, a Star Trek philosophy podcast by Zachary Fruling. I think that's how you pronounce it. Sorry, Zach. And Mike Morrison. And Decipher Sci-Fi by Christopher Peterson and Lee Colbert. Great company to be in. And just really honored that I was selected by the committee to win the Best Fact Behind the Fiction podcast for the 2017 Parsec Awards. Thank you guys so much. And thank you for being a big part of it. All right. I know you're excited to get into the interview this week. And I gotta admit, it's a really good one because it's the author of a great book. It's called American Wolf, A True Story of Survival and Obsession in the West. And you're going to hear all about it right now without any further ado. So here he is, Nate Blakeslee. Nate, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks. It's my pleasure.
All right. So we are going to be talking about your new book, which came out just a couple of months ago now, I think 3 months ago now, American Wolf, A True Story of Survival and Obsession in the West. And of course, this book really centers around quite a famous wolf named O6. Who is O6?
Well, she was probably the best known wolf in Yellowstone National Park during the time that she was alive. She wasn't the first famous wolf ever in Yellowstone, but she was sort of the first wolf who became popular with watchers during the Facebook era. And so she had a really active sort of life on social media. But she became famous mainly because she was the easiest wolf to spot in Yellowstone. And Yellowstone, if your listeners don't know, is the best place in the world to watch wolves. It's the only place in the world where you can reliably spot wolves from the roadside with a spotting scope.
And so when you say watch wolves, like wolf watching, is this a common pastime? People like to go to places like Yellowstone and just sit and watch?
Well, it wasn't until the mid-1990s when wolves were brought back to Yellowstone. They had been gone since the 1920s. There really was no place in the world where you could go and reliably find a wolf, even if you were a full-time biologist in the field studying wolves. For years, you might only have occasional sightings. But Yellowstone was different. They were reintroduced into this valley known as the Lamar Valley in the northeast corner of the park. It was wide open, relatively treeless. The biologists at the time that they brought wolves back, they assumed that they would sort of quickly leave the valley because there's a road going through it and it's popular with visitors. And some of them did, but some of them didn't. Some of them stayed and they didn't seem to mind the road. They don't get close to the visitors, but with these spotting scopes, these really powerful telescopes, you can watch them from a mile away and you can see everything. You can see the expressions on their faces. You can see them interact with one another. And that's why it's become this really popular pastime over the last 20 years in Yellowstone.
And of course, here in the United States, Yellowstone isn't the only place where wolves live, but it does seem that because of its unique landscape and ecology, it's actually the most popular place for people to see them.
Yeah, that's right. There's actually more wolves in the upper Midwest, although most people don't know that. In Michigan's upper peninsula, northern Minnesota, northern Wisconsin, there's about 3,700 gray wolves. It's the only place in the United States that they were never completely eliminated simply because it is so densely wooded and so inaccessible. But of course, that's also why it's not easy to spot wolves there. So they have never really become a tourist attraction there.
It's funny to think of wolves as a tourist attraction. And I guess that really is like the center of the controversy that you write about in this book, because it's much more than the story of O6, although it is kind of told through her perspective. It's really the story of how do we conserve? What is the appropriate way to be shepherds of, you know, of our land and of the organisms that live on it? Because at the heart of bringing back these wolves was a controversy, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. You know, we think of wildlife management as sort of a science-driven enterprise, and it is, but only up to a point. It's also a very political undertaking because not everybody agrees on what a perfect wilderness should look like, what animals ought to be left in and what ought to be left out. And that, nowhere has that been more true when it comes to wolves. Wolves are controversial, well, in the Northern Rockies for two reasons. One is that there's a lot of ranching in the Northern Rockies. In fact, the ancestors of those same ranchers that are there today are the people who helped eliminate wolves from the Northern Rockies, you know, mainly by the end of the 19th century. And then secondly, elk hunting is really big business in the Northern Rockies. It's not just the guide services, but also you've got your motels and restaurants that cater to elk hunters. People come from all over the world to hunt, and they hunt that Yellowstone elk herd, not while it's in the park, obviously, but elk are migratory, and they come down out of those high mountain ranges in the park and down into the valleys around the park where they can be hunted. And that's what makes it some of the most popular hunting in the country. And so that's why it was so controversial. And it was all driven by the federal government. And there was a lot of opposition on the ground, a lot of sort of us versus them, states' rights versus sort of federal control rhetoric that went on at the time that the decision was being made.
And just what about the core question of if an animal is threatened, should we displace, not displace them, but replace them? If an animal no longer exists in an area where they used to exist, should we take a population and transplant them there? Was anybody concerned simply about that kind of very first movement?
Well, what drove the program from the beginning was the fact that Yellowstone, despite being the crown jewel of the U.S. national park system, was broken. It was a broken ecosystem. And the reason it was broken is because its top predator was missing and had been for so long. Wolves had been hunted out of Yellowstone by the last known litter to be born in Yellowstone was in 1920. The last few remaining wolves, ironically, were killed by park rangers. At that time, there was only just a rudimentary understanding of what an ecosystem was. And the rangers honestly believed that left to their own devices, the wolves would destroy those giant herds of ungulates that had made the park so popular, the elk and the bighorn and the pronghorns. They did not realize that wolves and elk had coexisted on that landscape for thousands of years, since the end of the last ice age, basically, and that they had, in fact, evolved in tandem with one another, which is the reason that you know, elk can run just as fast as a wolf and no faster. And wolves, in fact, sculpted the whole natural world that you see in the Northern Rockies, not only there, but across most of the United States. Well, wolves were once found almost everywhere in North America, from the Arctic Circle down to present-day Mexico City. And all of these attributes we associate with these sort of beloved animals, the reason white-tailed deer are so nimble, the reason a bighorn can go straight up the side of a mountain, the reason a moose is so big, those are all strategies evolved over thousands of years in response to prey from wolves.
Yeah. And so early on, it was actually the people who are trying to manage Yellowstone, the people trying to preserve it, that in a way really did unknowingly destroy that ecosystem balance. But then later, once these wolves were reintroduced, there was a whole new wave of frustration, right? Because individuals who were used to there being no wolves were now kind of competing with them.
Right, right. And what I meant when I said the ecosystem was broken is basically there were too many elk, far, far too many elk, because the wolves were the only real predator that kept the elk in check. And so once the wolves were gone, the population just exploded. And biologists in the park could recognize that. As early as the 1940s, they started talking about, well, maybe we made a mistake. Maybe we should bring the wolves back. And what they were forced to do, because the habitat was degrading, other species were suffering, the willow and the aspen were disappearing, the range was just going to pot. And what they did was they would round up elk, usually in the winter when there were no visitors around to see, and they would shoot thousands of them, basically replace the wolves with bullets. And the idea that bringing wolves back would be a more sort of holistic solution to that had been around, as I say, since the 40s, but it was very controversial, and they didn't get it done until the mid-90s. And even after they got it done, you know, this fight over whether it was a good idea and whether or not the feds were properly managing wolves and whether or not the states ought instead to be allowed to manage wolves, which everyone knew would mean eventually a hunting season and a trapping season for wolves. That debate went on for 20 years, basically until About 5 to 7 years ago, when essentially the states won and they got the right to begin managing wolves again. And now, today, there are hunting seasons in Wyoming and Idaho, and Montana, the three states that surround Yellowstone.
There are hunting seasons for wolves.
Yes, for wolves. That has been brought back. Yeah.
And so why would people want to hunt wolves? Simply for their fur or because of these bigger concerns like, you know, somebody who has livestock wants to hunt a wolf so that they don't eat their livestock?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, originally, they were mainly eliminated from the United States by fur trappers. Fur trappers who wanted the valuable pelts. But this is the 19th century we're talking about. There's no such trade or nothing like that today. The main reason someone wants to shoot a wolf today is for the trophy. They want that skin for themselves. The same reason you would shoot a really large bull elk, you know, to get the trophy to hang on your wall. Or if you're a rancher, you would shoot them to protect stock. But that's an entirely different issue. That's a separate debate because even when wolves were first brought back in the mid-90s and were still enjoyed the protection of the Endangered Species Act, ranchers were allowed to kill wolves or have them killed on their behalf. A special exception was made in deference, frankly, to the power of the ranching industry in that part of the country, that if you had a wolf that was preying on sheep or cattle, even, by the way, on public land, because public land is leased to cattle ranchers out there, even if you had a wolf that was depredating on cattle and sheep, a government trapper would come out and shoot it for you. So you didn't need a trophy hunting season to solve that problem. So, and hundreds of wolves are still killed every year under that rubric too, under protecting livestock. But now we have this hunting and trapping season strictly for trophies, and hundreds of wolves are killed in those three states every year under that rubric too. And mostly it's just for sport.
Wow. And of course, that doesn't happen in Yellowstone proper. But then again, there are really no fences and wolves can travel wherever they'd like.
That's right. They have an enormous ranges. And even though the park is huge, you know, a wolf can cover routinely 20 miles in a day, 40 miles in a day if they need to. And so all of the packs that live in the park, there's about 10 packs that live in the park. They spend their majority of the time in the park. But as you say, there's no visible boundary line and they come and go. And the park is surrounded by this much larger wilderness. It's usually called the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem, and it's comprised of national forests and other protected wilderness land. In fact, it's the largest still remaining essentially intact temperate ecosystem left in the world. And so wolves will roam in and out of the park regularly. And if they do so in the fall, now they are fair game for hunters and trappers.
Wow. You know, it reminds me of, you were talking about the sort of loophole, I guess we could say, for farmers or for ranchers. We have something similar here in California. And quite famously, you know, our 06, because we don't have wolves in California, at least not in Southern California. I think we may have had some that have ventured down into Northern California and then kind of went back into Oregon recently. But our sort of famous animal is P22. P22 is a mountain lion living here. And we've talked about P22 on the show before. I've had some people on to discuss the plight of P22 and, you know, why we need connectivity. But famously recently, and this didn't involve P22, it involved another Santa Monica mountain lion. There was a big controversy because a farmer kind of had a bounty on this mountain lion who had killed some of the farmer's livestock. And luckily, I think because of such a public outcry, they called it off. But this, of course, is a very urban area. This is a place where a lot of people are working to preserve what little green space and wild space we still have. But in places like you were mentioning, the wilderness around Yellowstone, it's incredibly rural if there's even anybody living there at all.
Yeah. Well, there's those little communities around the sides of the park, but you're right. It's one of the remotest places in the lower 48. It is.
It interests me because I think that one of the things I struggle with as a science journalist, and I have a lot of friends who write in this area specifically, urban ecology, urban wildlife, conservation. One of the things that I'm always fascinated by and am, I have to admit, a bit naive about is how do we approach conservation appropriately? And are there times, which I know the answer is yes, when the sort of conservation movement, the green movement that's not necessarily evidence-based, but much more activist-based, is doing more harm than good by, you know, we sometimes derogatorily call them the bunny huggers, which I think is like not the nicest thing to say, but yeah. We see it a lot here in Los Angeles. The PETA kind of crowd, which is not always using good science-based practices, but there's a deep emotional connection to animals. And of course, at their core, nobody wants to see animals suffer.
Right, right. Well, and that's you raise a good point. In the discussion of P22, there are a lot of similar themes to what went on with 06 in Yellowstone. What does it mean when a wild animal becomes famous? How can a wild animal be famous? You know, it's a strange thing to even wrap your head around to begin with. And then the next question, as you pointed out, is it a good thing for a wild animal to be famous? And I think probably on balance, the 06's fame and the fame of other wolves who came before her has been a good thing for wolf reintroduction. I think I would say so, because, you know, for as long as we have had recorded history, people have demonized wolves. And this is a function of wolves being the main obstacle that every sort of pastoral civilization throughout history had to overcome. In order to have land to raise livestock and in order to protect those livestock, wolves had to go, or that was the perspective of those early civilizations. And wolves were once the most widely distributed land mammal on the planet, found almost everywhere in the Northern Hemisphere. And today, Homo sapiens is that animal, and wolves live essentially kind of on the margins of human civilization. But they have been demonized for so long that they could use some good press, you know? And that's the perspective you get from, say, for example, the people that run the Wolf Project in Yellowstone, the federal government biologists who brought wolves back from Canada and reintroduced them to the park and have studied them in the park. They're not bunny huggers. Almost everybody up there is an elk hunter. The guys that run the Yellowstone Wolf Project are elk hunters themselves. They don't give the wolves nicknames. They give them numbers. They don't believe that their wolves are sacred. You know, they signed off on this idea that wolves that prey on cattle and sheep should be shot, and have authorized and in some cases actually done it themselves. At the same time, they have, I think, a compelling argument that when wolves leave the park, especially wolves that have been studied for years and years and are wearing tracking collars and are shot in areas adjacent to the park, that it's harmful to their research and harmful to their project. And so I think they make a point, without being bunny huggers, I think they make a point that there is a strong case against trophy hunting. And sometimes when you dig into these rationales behind why trophy hunting is necessary, there's often not a lot of there. I mean, one of the things that you'll hear people say is, well, we've got to do it in order to protect livestock. Well, as we've already discussed, you don't. You have government hunters and trappers to do that. And then you hear, well, we've got to do it to protect elk numbers. Well, keep in mind that the reason wolves were brought back to Yellowstone to begin with was to reduce that burdensome elk population in the park. Now, if you lived adjacent to the park and you hunted that elk population and your granddad did and his dad, then you never thought there were too many elk in Yellowstone. You know, you thought there were just the right amount. And so if you didn't share that policy goal of reducing that herd, then you weren't likely to celebrate its success. But that doesn't mean it wasn't a good policy goal to begin with.
I see. And that argument is now extended into areas that are, I think, in the view of some people, more egregious, but also, I think, much more interesting from an ethics perspective, which is trophy hunting, not for antlers of ungulates that are abundant here in the United States, but trophy hunting for other endangered creatures throughout the world. You know, we're seeing these movements in certain countries for trophy hunting programs under the, I don't want to say guise, because again, it's quite controversial and there is, I don't know, it seems like there's some good rationale behind it. Maybe there's not, but under the guise of conserving those very animals that are being killed.
Yeah, you do hear that argument, especially in the Serengeti. You'll hear, well, the enormous fees, and they are enormous fees paid by someone who's come here to shoot an elephant or a rhinoceros or a lion, help fund conservation in those countries. And you hear something similar here too. I mean, you know, the Wildlife, Fish and Game Department, just like the Game Department, I'm sure in California and here in Texas where I live, is funded largely by permits bought by hunters and fishers. But you know, what gets lost when you have an arrangement like that? That's what we don't always ask, because what you get then is you get an agency that is in charge of managing wildlife that is in which the customer is always right, and the customer is the hunter or the fisherman. And so you get management not necessarily for balanced ecosystems. You get management for a surplus of one desired species, the one that brings in the money. And I think it's a fair question to ask whether or not that is a sound basis on which to make those policy decisions.
It's such an interesting thing to think about. You know, I grew up in Texas as well, and lived there 25 years of my life, and we grew up hunting deer. Deer is just a pastime of so many Texans, you know. And it's funny because my dad, he's older now, and I've talked to him about it, and I have no problem with deer hunting. We would always eat the deer. And yes, we had trophies on our wall, but we would always, you know, he would have these fun anatomy lessons with me where we would open up the stomach and see, you know, all the grass that it had eaten. And, you know, it's like, it really was a pastime. And, you know, the argument when we were young was always, there are so many deer. We actually have to, we have to hunt to keep their numbers in check, because we have, we've really changed the ecosystem in such a way that there aren't enough predators. So we have to take the place of that. But of course, now that he's older, even he says, you know, I just can't kill an animal anymore.
That's interesting.
Like, it was one thing when I was young. But yeah, he's really changed his approach to it. He's like, you know, we have plenty of meat. I don't need to do this.
Although maybe he doesn't necessarily object to other people doing it.
It's interesting because they're in Texas, and maybe it's low hanging fruit with deer in Texas that it's true. You know, there are rules you abide by. You can only hunt during the right season. You can only kill the right gender. You can only do it with a permit. And there are just a ton of deer.
anybody can see that there are far too many whitetails, especially in central Texas where I live. I mean, they are everywhere. And it's for the same reason that they were overrunning the Yellowstone ecosystem. It's because the predators are gone. And the predators are gone for the same reason. Years and years and years of aggressive predator control by ranchers, you know, is the reason we have the situation we have now. But it's, as you say, it's difficult to argue with the idea that something has to be done. Otherwise, you have starving whitetails and you have diseased whitetails. So it's an undesirable situation, and you know, it's in need of some sort of solution.
And it's just so complex, because it's not just the apex predator and then the ungulate. It's, you know, the small mammals, it's the reptiles, it's the birds, it's the fish, it's even the insects that are all, even the bacteria that are also tightly related. And that's when you see, exactly like you said, certain diseases pop up because one animal is too abundant. And these, you know, let's say parasites are finding easier sources. Like, it's just so complicated. And I don't want to say you can't blame the government agencies, because of course somebody has to be accountable, but it must be a difficult position to be in when you're trying to answer to so many masters.
Oh, it's very tricky. And, you know, I talked to quite a few game managers in areas adjacent to the park, and they really resent the fact that O6 became famous, or that any wolf or wild animal could become famous, because they feel like it makes their job harder and it politicizes their job. And to some degree, I sympathize with that. On the other hand, I also know that there's just this fatigue, not only amongst them, but also in the Fish and Wildlife Service. They are tired of fighting about wolves. You know, it's been 20 years. And to some degree, they have thrown up their hands and acquiesced to what I think a lot of reasonable observers have said has been some pretty irresponsible policy decisions just to make this issue go away, because they're tired of fighting about it.
Well, guys, I want to take a quick break from the show to thank the sponsors of this week's episode, starting with the great courses. And of course, it's a new year and we've got our New Year's resolutions. And what better resolution than to learn new things this year? One of the best ways to do that is by watching and listening to the Great Courses Plus. You can discover interesting information about people, places, and ideas in almost any category you can come up with, because you get unlimited access to thousands of topics with fascinating insights from the world's leading professors and experts. One of the shows that I'm really into, that I'm really into right now on the Great Courses Plus is the Higgs boson and beyond. And you know what? I've had Sean Carroll on my show before. He was one of my most popular episodes. If you want to learn all about the Higgs boson discovery direct from Sean Carroll and really understand the insights that he can offer into understanding really how you can think of a field instead of a particle, getting a deeper, breadth of knowledge about what the Higgs is, what it means, and why without it there would be no atoms, no molecules, no biology, no life. You've got to watch the Higgs boson and beyond as well. And you can watch it from any TV, any laptop, any tablet or smartphone, or you can listen along podcast style with the Great Courses Plus app. So start the year off right. Sign up for the Great Courses Plus. You'll get so much out of it. And because you are my special Talk Nerdy listeners, you get a free trial to learn about anything. So go to my special URL. It's thegreatcoursesplus.com/nerdy to start your free trial today. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/nerdy. I also want to thank Blue Apron for their support of the show. I love Blue Apron. I know I've been telling you about it for quite a while now because I can't stop eating it. And part of the reason that I love Blue Apron is because it's so convenient. There's so much variety, and it really does make people like me who don't pride themselves on their cooking, prowess. It makes me feel like I know what I'm doing. So let me explain how it works. You go to the website, you pick the meals that look good to you. It's totally customizable. And then you get them delivered directly to your door, perfectly portioned ingredients, a beautiful full color step-by-step recipe guide. And most of these things can be cooked in under 45 minutes, sometimes in under 30 minutes. And you have a great meal for your family. You get to bond by cooking together and taste something that you might not have thought to cook otherwise. So let's see what's on the menu this week. So many options. Sweet and sour vegetable stir fry with fried eggs and peanuts. Yum. Roasted pork and broccoli with apple cheese sauce and garlic breadcrumbs. And what about next week? Let's see. Mushroom and goat cheese quiche with romaine salad and Meyer lemon vinaigrette, or even crispy chicken and Italian tomato sauce with potatoes and Swiss chard. And of course, if you're a meat eater, if you're a fish eater, if you don't eat meat or fish, that's not a thing. If you don't eat either one and you want to go completely vegetarian, there's an option for everybody. So I don't know what you're waiting for, because right now you, the Talk Nerdy listeners, are being treated to your first dinner on Blue Apron. It's a $30 value, and all you've got to do is go to blueapron.com/nerdy. And not only do you get $30 off, you also get free shipping. What are you waiting for? Go to blueapron.com/nerdy. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. Are there other solutions that have been raised for hunters who, I mean, at a certain point, it's a business, or I'm sorry, not hunters, ranchers. It's a business. Yeah. They're trying to keep their cattle. They're trying to keep, their pigs, whatever it is, and they just keep getting eaten.
Well, the problem has to be kept in perspective. I mean, it is the case that some ranchers have lost calves. This is mainly what the wolves will get. But not on a basis that has threatened the industry as a whole. Just as an example, last year, about 230 cattle and sheep were lost in the state of Wyoming. You can probably guess there are an awful lot of cattle and sheep in Wyoming. There's probably over a million. And just to put that number, 230, in perspective, tens of thousands are lost every year to bad weather or respiratory diseases. So it hasn't had this sort of impact that some of the sort of doomsayers had said it would. Now, if all 230 of those were lost on the same ranch, obviously that's a significant loss. But there are compensation programs in place. The state of Wyoming will compensate you 7 times the value of the calf or sheep you lost if you lose one, if you can verify that it was lost to a wolf. The idea being that you probably had some other losses that you weren't able to document, or that you had some less tangible losses, like you had a skittish cow that, you know, had fewer offspring for whatever reason. So they are compensated. And as I said, you know, it's not like their hands are tied. If they have a wolf that's depredating on their property, or as I said before, on public land where they're running their sheep or cattle, they call this division of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, it's called Wildlife Services. It's been around forever, and they will come out and shoot that wolf for you. So it's not as, or that mountain lion, you know, or haze that bear off or kill that eagle that's eating your lambs. So it's not as if they can't do, they don't have resources at their disposal. And with respect to elk hunting, I mean, yes, there are fewer elk in those areas around the park, but on a statewide basis, the elk harvest, as they call the number of elk that are shot by hunters every year, has been robust. It's been near record levels in the last few years. So there is still plenty of good elk hunting to be had in Wyoming and Idaho and Montana. It's just not necessarily in the same areas where it historically was.
So then I'm interested in what you think as somebody who has taken, you know, years to dig deep into this issue and do a lot of research in writing this book. Do you think that this is a manufactured controversy? Is this just a function of really good lobbying?
Well, I think that the ranchers had legitimate concerns and that, you know, the outfitters had legitimate concerns. But now I think what we're looking at 20 years on is just that the politics around the issue has become really poisonous. And we're not even really fighting so much about wolves or any one policy anymore. It's become this kind of proxy or stand-in for this larger debate over land use in the West and who ought to be able to decide how that land's used. Your listeners probably know that large portions of the West are controlled by the federal government. The state of Idaho, for example, 2/3 of that is federal land. And so you have this situation, which is not new, it's been going on for a long time, in which the people that run the state of Idaho, the ranchers and the loggers and the governor, they don't really get to say how the resources in their own state are used. And for a long time, when those federal bureaucracies, the Forest Service, for example, when resource extraction was the number one goal, that wasn't a problem. But when the environmental movement came into play and there started to be restrictions on logging and mining, then all of a sudden it was a problem. And this fight over wolves is part and parcel of the same fight that's been going on for decades over whether and how decisions ought to be made about those Western lands and who should get to say and who should get to benefit.
You know, it's so incredibly complicated. Obviously, there's no one real answer, but coming from, you know, this sort of privileged position here in the West and sitting in this chair, doing this podcast, reading the things that I read, doing the work that I do, I always come back to the same conclusion, which is that regardless of the decisions that are made, they should be evidence-based. Do you feel like a lot of the controversy surrounding, especially the issue of the wolf, but these larger conservation issues of sort of what we think of as classic American animals, have science behind them? Or do you think that they've moved kind of far away from the science?
Well, we tend to forget how politicized the process is. And that was an eye-opener for me in reporting this book, and I hope it will be revelatory to people that decide to read it. You know, we think of wilderness as sort of the opposite of civilization. There's the natural world, and then there's the world we've made for ourselves. But in a place like the West, which has been so thoroughly exploited for so long, you know, for timber and for fur and for gold and oil and gas, wilderness is something that has to be created by people, as counterintuitive as that may sound. And that inevitably means it becomes part of, you know, the great swap meet that goes on in Congress over any issue in which there will be winners and losers. And there always are in every decision-making process. And there are with respect to wolves, too. And so I go into this quite a bit in the book. You know, as you say, the story, it's the story of one wolf pack, 06, but it's also the story of this fight over how wolves should be managed. And a lot of the decisions were made not, as you say, based on science or not simply on science, but on political considerations, including, amazingly, over whether or not Democrats or Republicans would control the United States Senate in 2012. Wolves became an issue in one of the key races, which in turn helped determine whether or not Obamacare would live past its infancy. They were actually talking about wolves in the same breath as preserving Obama's legacy. And it got caught up in all of that, you know, as, along with all those other sort of litmus test issues that become wedge issues in those big elections. So I think the short answer to your question is both. You know, there's always, you dig under the surface, there'll always be some politics underlying what seems to be a decision that's based on science.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it doesn't follow what we think of as being cleanly or purely partisan. I think that ostensibly, you know, you've got the liberals like myself who aren't always thinking, I should not have worded that way. I threw myself into the conversation too early. Let me rephrase this. You've got people who ostensibly think that the liberals are, you know, the bunny huggers, that they're all environmental activists, that they're actually too extreme on kind of the green side of things, the environmental side of things, and they cannot see the forest for the trees. And then you've got the other assumption, which is that conservatives are all bloodlusting hunters and they're not concerned at all about conservation or about shepherding the planet as a whole. But of course, there are tons of left-wingers who care about good evidence-based policy, and there are tons of right-wingers who are really concerned about conservation and about being shepherds of nature. And so you've got this really complicated political discourse, don't you?
You certainly do. And I'm glad you said that. And, the organizations that are opposed to wolves because they are composed of elk hunters, those elk hunting organizations, they think of themselves as conservation organizations. And to an extent, they are. I mean, they spend a lot of time making sure habitat is, one, available for elk to live on, and two, open to the public so that it can be hunted on. But of course, if it's open to the public, you know, it's open for other uses as well. So you're right. The lines are not clearly drawn. They're not even clearly drawn when it comes to who's anti-wolf and pro-wolf. I mean, hunters and ranchers have made common cause against wolves, but they are far from natural allies. Most ranchers in the West would like to see fewer elk on the landscape, especially if they ranch on public lands, because elk are enormous animals. They're basically like beef cattle with long legs, and they eat a lot of grass. And the last thing you want to see if you're a rancher in the West, you know, you're paying to water alfalfa for your cattle. You wake up in the morning and there's 100 elk out there, you know, and it's frustrating. It's very frustrating. And so they would like to see fewer elk. So one part of them, I'm sure, celebrates the success of wolf reintroduction because there are fewer elk out there. So the battle lines are not as clearly drawn as they seem to be.
Yeah, it's so complicated. Like, you know, I consider myself pro-wolf, if you were to ask. Are you pro-wolf or anti-wolf? Well, of course I'm pro-wolf until there's a wolf trying to get in my front door. You know what I mean? It's like everybody has those limits as well. I mean, we talk about it with coyotes here in Los Angeles. It's a big issue. Urban coyotes who, of course, we want them to be free, but at the same time, they've become so habituated to people that they've become a danger to people's property and to people's pets. And then you have this whole difficult series of events where people are using rat poison, and then you have mange problems. And it's just so complicated trying to figure out how to harmoniously live together. It requires a lot of regulation. It's not just something that's going to passively happen.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I'd be remiss if I didn't say, just for the record, that although a wolf, like a coyote, is very dangerous to your pet and also could potentially be dangerous to your calves or your sheep, not likely to be dangerous to you. No, there's been no recorded instance of anyone being harmed by a wolf in the 20 years since reintroduction in the Northern Rockies. And that's with millions of people coming to visit Yellowstone, you know, every year.
Oh, that's wonderful. And the only, a friend of mine was actually sharing a news report from just the other day where some people were stargazing in greater LA and they got bit by a coyote. And we had a conversation amongst all of my scientist friends and conservationist friends on this thread about how the only reason that coyotes really can be dangerous, even though by and large they're not, to people is because people are dumb and do things like feed them out of their cars. They have habituated them to not be afraid of us. And that's our fault. You know, if we hadn't done that, if we did what we're supposed to do, and every time a coyote came anywhere near us, we were loud, you know, we honked the horn, we shook a can of pennies, we did whatever we could do to show them that we are dangerous and they should be afraid of us, they'd be less likely to come close.
Yeah, yeah. Although you would think historically, with the number of coyotes that have been killed by humans over the year, which is absolutely incalculable number, that they would be so afraid of people by now. But, you know, who can understand the mind of a coyote?
Exactly. Right? Yeah. And it's just so interesting to me how we can have such a big disconnect in our minds between a wild dog and a domestic dog, which of course our own pets, our loved ones, I say this right now because I have this little floofer nut just like sleeping in my hands right now. I don't even have free hands because he's pinned them down underneath his chin. And he's, you know, he's my everything. Yet a wild wolf, I could go out and kill. It just, to me, that's a really strange disconnect because he was a wolf only, you know, a few tens of thousands of years ago.
You're right. And you've touched on something that is fascinating. It's the paradox of how we think about wolves. So a wolf and a dog are essentially the same creature, which means that our most beloved creature and our, for centuries, most despised were essentially the same animal. No, you're right. It's fascinating. And all those qualities that you admire in your dog, the loyalty and the resilience and the empathy, all of those qualities came from wolves, from you know, thousands of years of adaptations by wolves, especially the empathy. You know, wolves, they're kind of known as these sort of remorseless killers, and they are very good at killing elk. But when you watch them through the scope, you can see the empathy. And it's not your imagination, and it's not anthropomorphizing. Wolves, unlike, say, mountain lions or grizzlies, they spend almost all of their life in the company of other wolves. Mountain lions or grizzlies will be by themselves 90% of the time. And wolves do everything collectively as a pack. They raise their young collectively. They feed them collectively. They hunt collectively. They defend the den collectively. And so being able to understand the inner state of your fellow wolf, to understand their emotional state and respond accordingly, is an adaptation that has been selected for over the millennia, just like their amazing sense of smell or their agility or their stamina. It's real, and it has a real biological reason for its existence.
And it's so connected in such a deep way that I think part of the reason that we're able to have that paradox is simply because, you know, these little nuggets live in our homes and the wolves don't. And we can only see them from afar, which is a good thing. You know, it's funny. I think you'll love this. I opened up Instagram this morning. It was so kind of odd, I think, the timing, a coincidence. My friend Brian Switek, who is a pretty famous writer, I've had him on the show before. He's sort of the paleontology journalist, like sort of the young journalist who covers dinosaurs a lot. And he writes for every outlet you can imagine. He's written a few great books. I opened up my Instagram and there was a picture through a spotting scope that said, and then his caption was, "I just finished American Wolf by Nate Blakeslee." It reminded me of a crisp August morning spent watching some Hayden Valley wolves feast a bison carcass in Yellowstone last year.
That's great. That's great. That's
and it's a wonderful photo that he took through his scope. So I was like, well, gosh, that's kismet for today.
Definitely.
I had to share that with you. So, you know, we didn't dive deep into what happens to O6, mostly because I don't want to give it away.
Well, thank you.
But obviously I think that style of storytelling is so important and it's so meaningful. And I think that in many ways, other than just kind of the important content of your book, the creative approach to how you tell this story is what really makes it resonate with people. Because of course, we are empathic animals. We don't always seem that way when you read the headlines, but truth be told, as these primates, as Homo sapiens, like, we connect with storytelling where there's a strong protagonist, and there's no reason that an animal, a beloved animal, can't be a strong protagonist. And so I think it's really neat that that your story really centers around O6. And I'm just really glad that you took the time to write this tale so that you could share something with people who maybe don't, you know, have the opportunity in their lives to experience the wild or to experience nature the way that I think we all deep down wish that we could.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear you say that. And it was important to me that the book tell a good story for two reasons. One, just so that people would reach the end of it, but also because the story, the fact that the book tells a story, is part of the message of the book. You know, it's if you If you are, say, for example, a game manager in Wyoming, and your job is to assess, well, how many wolves can we afford to lose to hunters and trappers and on behalf of livestock this year, you know, before the feds will step back in and put the wolf back on the endangered species list, which is what we don't want, you know, if you're a wildlife game manager in Wyoming. And the answer is always in the hundreds. You know, that's the calculus that is made. But the book hopefully asks readers to ask a different question, which is, what is the value of one wolf's life? And if every wolf lives this amazing adventure story, which O6's life was, and by the way, she wasn't unusual. The only thing that was unusual about her is we had enough detail about her life because she was so famous and her life was so well chronicled that it could be told in that level of detail, but her life was not unusual. So if every wolf lives a life like that, and every time a wolf is shot, you know, not just a famous wolf, but any sort of anonymous wolf in the Northern Rockies, if every time that happens, it ends this amazing story, does it cause us to think differently about those sort of policy decisions that get made in places like the Wyoming Game and Fish Office? I hope the answer is yes, but I will leave that to readers to decide.
Well, Nate, I've kept you like for quite a while, and I know that we have a tight time crunch, but I hope that you won't be offended if I ask. At the very end of my show, I always ask my guests the same two questions. And when I forget or I run out of time, I really hear it from my listeners. So hopefully you're willing to stay just a couple minutes longer and share your perspective of these two questions. So here they are. The first one is sort of the negative side of the coin. And that is, in whatever context is important to you right now, it could be your own personal life, or it could be, you know, just the really big global picture. Number one, what is the thing that keeps you up the most at night? What are you most concerned about? What are you most worried about when it comes to the future? And on the flip side of that, just so we end on a more positive note, when you're thinking about the future, what are you most kind of hopeful and optimistic about?
Wow. Well, that really is a big picture question, isn't it?
Yep. Yep.
I worry, I would assume probably about what most people in this country are at least somewhat worried about, which is the level of public discourse, the lack of, you know, as a journalist, obviously it disturbs me greatly to see the amount of sort of, just the wanton and kind of brazen attacks on journalism as an industry. And on the very notion that there is something called objective truth and the notion that, you know, we can simply create our own truth through, and not that that is something that's new. I mean, you know, spin has been going on for quite some time, but at least it was done with a sort of, kind of delicacy and subtleness that is just sort of gone now from public discourse. Now there seems to be two sets of facts, just depending on which TV station you watch in the evening. And I find that very distressing. But then as in terms of cause for hope, I see this amazing response to that. Not only among my fellow journalistic professionals, but also just among, people in general who have become much more active politically because of how alarmed they are at the prospect of that. But also in journalism, too. I mean, the New York Times is so reinvigorated and has been by what's been going on in Washington and the Washington Post, too. And it's been exciting for me to see as a journalist. And so I think that the institution will bounce back stronger than ever when all this is over. And I'm hoping that will be the case. And I'm hoping that we will just remember this as sort of a blip, an unfortunate sort of blemish on our democracy 10 years from now. Does that answer your question? I hope so.
I think it does. And I think it's interesting because this is a common theme. Actually, it's a less common theme on my show because my show is often very heavy science. So it's usually like a conversation about climate change at the end. But it is a common theme that we tend to think in this paradoxical or dichotomous way, where the thing that we're most concerned about is also the thing that we're often most hopeful for, because through struggle, we usually will see progress. And so that's really, I think, refreshing when we get to have those conversations. It definitely can help when we're having one of those days where we just can't bear to look at our phones in the morning because the news is just too depressing.
Absolutely. But I agree with you. I think that's well put.
Absolutely. Well, Nate, thank you so much for joining me. Guys, the book is American Wolf, a true story of survival and obsession in the West. It's available anywhere books are sold. I'll have a link in my show notes. And Nate, are you active on social media? Is there a place where people can kind of find you on Tay Interwebs to see your more of your work?
I have a Twitter account. It's just at Nate Blakeslee. Not on Facebook. Somehow I've managed to avoid that. I'm waiting to see if it catches on.
I was going to say, good for you.
But there's more about the book at the Penguin Random House website.
Great. And of course, if people follow you on Twitter, they can see the other work that you do, because you didn't just write this book. You have a previous book, and you are an active journalist who writes quite often, right?
Yes. Yes, I am. So I invite people to do that. I hope that they will.
Excellent. Well, Nate, again, thank you so much for joining me. It was really, really enlightening. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.